Welcome to, well, that fucked me up.
It really did.
A podcast with Luke Coulson.
And Kyle Wise.
And each week we're going to be talking to real guests about their amazing, often traumatic, life-changing events.
Focusing on stories of survival, hope, and overall triumph.
Which is flipping awesome.
Yeah.
Because we're all about that. We're all about listening to people's stories about adversity and trauma and crazy stuff. I think there really is something for everybody. There's many, many topics, many, many guests, people that really have got through some extraordinary things. Please share the love, share the show, get in touch, follow us, subscribe, click. We're trying to make it easy and open for people to discuss things that may normally feel tricky to do so. We've been on an extraordinary journey and we're glad you can join us. Enjoy the show. This is another episode of Well, That Fucked Me Up, a podcast with Luke Coulson and Kyle Wise. Today, I'm excited to introduce our guest, Robin. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
Hello.
Robin's English, which is very exciting. No, don't apologize. God, never apologize. Don't apologize.
I'm not Canadian. Be apologized.
That's hilarious. Oh my God, good start. So we've been having a good chat before we came on and reminiscing about all things English. I'm excited to hear your story, Robin. You made some contact with us because you thought you had a story that suited the title. Well, that fucked me up, and I think that's where we shall start. Give us a little bit of background, or whatever background you think is relevant, whether that's, you know, kind of your lifestyle or anything leading up to your pivotal moment, and then we'll just go back and forth, do some questions, see how we get on.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me. You know, I'm a little bit nervous because I've listened to your show for a while now.
Don't be nervous.
Luke, that's...
I love that.
Like be on the telly. I'm like all nervous.
Oh, no, don't be nervous. And also, we'll just make it as a nice back and forth chit chat. And I don't think, I think you'll soon get into it. You don't sound nervous anyway, so.
I think so too. But having listened to your show, it caused me to go back and think. I kind of went back to the start. What sequence of events led to Robin being airlifted out of the 2000 Glastonbury Festival on the Monday morning after it had all closed?
Oh, see, I've got goosebumps already just from that little prefix you gave us. That's the best teaser ever. And we'll get to that event. Yeah, so what do you think did lead to that event? Like, what was going on and how did you get there?
I cast my mind back to my childhood and thought it was a fairly unremarkable childhood.
Yes.
We weren't very well off, but we were well looked after. Tail end of Gen X, so very much a latchkey kid. Go off on your bikes down the park in the West Midlands. It was a little bit less... there weren't many rough kids about or anything like your childhood in London.
Interesting.
It was a little bit more bucolic and countrysidey.
Yes.
Go down the woods and start a fire or build a den.
I love it.
Go down the park. That kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I never really felt like I fit in. I always felt like a bit of an outsider, a bit of a nerdy kid, geeky kid, more at home. I'd rather play on my Spectrum 48K plus.
I had a Commodore 64. Commodore 64 after that, actually. Quite good,
mate.
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh. I'll have to have a fight about that later.
Yeah.
And Super Nintendo, Amiga, all of the games machines growing up.
And
I'd rather do that. And I was kind of forced to go out all day, every day on my bike because my parents were working.
Right.
And if I wasn't out with people, I would have to be at my grandparents'. Deadheading flowers.
All kinds of fun with the deadheading flower pastime. Brilliant.
Those were the days. Yeah. Well, they weren't really. Because I was kind of deeply unhappy because I didn't fit in. this nerdy, awkward, shy kid,
yeah.
And felt a little bit abandoned by my parents because they were out all day, every day.
Right.
Didn't really fit in at school, didn't have a big close group of mates or anything like that. Got on with the neighbourhood kids okay, and we'd go off on our bikes and get into a little bit of mischief and, you know, the classic find pornography in the woods as you did back in the days.
Or for us, it was like in someone's front yard or like in the trash bins. And it's like, oh my God, like now thinking about the germs from COVID, God only knows, you know?
Oh, hell, yeah. secondhand porn germs.
That in itself is the is a title for the next podcast that we'll launch called Secondhand Porn Germs. can I ask a question? Did you know that you were unhappy and felt abandoned when you were a kid? Or do you think now it's in hindsight that you're grown up and you've experienced some things you've experienced that you can pinpoint that a bit more?
Oh, yeah. It's only as an adult that I get that. I can look back and go, yeah, that was an unhappy kid.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of my memories, weirdly, are in the third person. So I'm very dissociated from those memories.
Oh, dude, same.
I see myself in them rather than seeing them through my own eyes. So, and I didn't know that was weird relatively recently.
That's amazing. And that is, I can't tell you how much I relate to that. I have issues with memory from anything before the age of 10. And I'm wondering if it's maybe even anything before the age of when I went through that accident with my friend. And and the memories that I do have, I only just recently realized, are the photographs that are on my mum's wall in her apartment. And they're not memories at all.
Interesting the way we file things away.
Yeah. Anyway, so we saw
representations of maybe more of the feelings than the actual thing that was
maybe, yeah,
that was happening.
Yeah.
And then at the age of 11, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
Gosh.
That's the injecty kind.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, no, thanks for clarifying that. Yeah, that's the tough one where you got to inject yourself with insulin. Is that correct?
That's right. And back then it was vials of insulin and syringes and pricking fingers and checking blood glucose. And apparently up until that point, I'd been, I don't remember this, sort of struggling to put one foot in front of the other.
Oh, wow.
Dragging myself down the road to get to school, to get to my family's house, to get to my grandparents for dinner. And almost wasted away. I looked like, you know, an incredibly unwell kid. Like, you could see my rib bones and
cage. Did you think that there was something wrong with you then from a kind of physical illness point of view? Was it your parents that shipped you off to the doctor, or did you sort of say, look, something's wrong here?
It was my parents. I just assumed that that's how it was.
Wow.
It was my mom who went, taking you to the doctor's, kiddo. In fact, I remember a couple of days before, there'd been an ITV drama about a kid with diabetes, and I was devastated at the end because you know, I didn't understand it. This kid, I thought he'd get better at the end, and he wasn't. And then a week later, there was me studying the doctors. The doctor, I remember the doctor going, yes, Mrs. Bates, it's what you thought it was.
Like, oh my gosh.
Address me, thank you very much.
That's terrifying, isn't it? And it's funny that this isn't necessarily the event that brought you on here, but of course it's all related. And to go through something at that age, and also to have a kind of secondary thought based on something you'd seen on TV. And I'm just going to jump in here, but when I was a kid, they made us watch that BBC drama Threads about dropping a nuclear bomb on Sheffield.
God.
And what the aftermath would be if a nuclear bomb hit a city in England. They put that was on the school curriculum at one stage. And of course, subsequently, that's, you can find that on the top 10 list of most disturbing films ever made. And they were showing that to children. I mean, it's like something out of A Clockwork Orange. And I remember,
it's hugely traumatic.
2 years after that, I thought I was going to die in a nuclear explosion. And I remember what very specifically one night, all around the time in my childhood where I was fucking terrified as it was, I remember hearing like an old air siren go off, which I think was probably faulty. And it was coming from like a rugby ground in Putney or something over the river. And I thought, this is it. So yeah, this is it. The nuclear attack's happening. Can you imagine?
So, yeah, they get used for a variety of things. It's just that you get a chill.
Yeah.
Like, it's just awful.
Horrible.
That sound went to a bonfire, a fireworks night in Victoria Park in East End, commemorating the end of the war and the Blitz. Yeah. And they used the air raid sirens. Like, this is really inappropriate.
Oh my
Imagine
gosh.
There's probably people shitting themselves as things are exploding.
Yeah, that's not...
air raid sirens are going off.
That's
what
not,
the hell?
That's not good. That's not
it's
good
dark.
At all. Okay, so that's very dark. Okay, so you've just been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 11.
The age of 11. And it's weird. I remember at that point, it's almost like... I'm trying to use a phrase for your Americanness. It's like a stick had been removed from my butt.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
And I very much sort of came alive a bit.
Wow.
And I was much more fun and started to enjoy myself a bit more.
Right.
And then I maybe started to enjoy myself a little bit too much. I still didn't feel like I fit in.
Right.
I was still on the periphery, but I wasn't, it's not like I was bullied. I wasn't picked on, especially. I was just sort of maybe a little bit of an outsider.
Right.
A few, handful of friends.
Yeah.
At the age of 14, overnight, I got a tattoo. Got my head shaved, got an earring.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Was alcohol involved at this stage?
It was about to.
Great. That's what I thought might be coming. Yeah. I don't mean to say, that's me. Great. Love a bit of
childhood
alcoholism. Perfectly. Well, I mean, I can relate to that. So yeah, let's dive into that. Well, so a tattoo, head shaved, an earring. And how did your parents feel about that?
I'm still not sure.
That's so funny.
Like, my dad actually took me to get my ear pierced.
Oh, there we go. That's nice.
That's nice. That was one good memory I have.
That is nice, actually. Yeah. To be honest with you, I got two kids, and my eldest is 11, and I think I'd be... I mean, not the tattoo, for sure. He can decide on that when he's of a legal age, whatever that is. But I don't know. If he was 14, 15, and that was the... Well, the look he wanted, and sure, why not, you know? Yeah.
So I'd turned from, like, a nice boy, good kid, to a bit of a thuggish brute.
I love it.
Overnight. Not necessarily a personality, but I started acting out. I started playing up, started pushing the boundaries.
Right.
A lot at school, getting in trouble with the police.
Wow.
But, like, for, drinking downtown, I had a party while my parents were out of town. And one girl brought a bottle of sherry with her.
Oof.
And proceeded to drink the whole bottle of sherry.
Oh.
And then was an absolute fucking state on the floor. And one of the party goers decided to phone for an ambulance. So he dialed 999 on the on the handset. We had a push phone.
Yeah.
No, so beep, beep, beep.
Yeah.
And then chickened out and went to put the phone down. Missed the handset holder.
Oh.
So all they heard was a bunch of 14-year-old kids screaming.
Oh, wow.
Traced the call and sent the police round. Of course, some of the girls had brought bigger boys with them who were smoking weed.
Oh, my gosh.
So the police found the weed as well. So off to the police station we went while my parents were away. Fortunately, I kind of got out of that one scot-free by just apologising.
Yeah. I feel like in those situations, I mean, you mentioned setting things on fire. I think we went around setting dustbins on fire in Bishop's Park one night. And, the police came and... They just want to just try and make sure you don't do it again. I don't think they're interested in taking you, giving you a criminal record at that stage. There must be so many teenagers who are drinking and smoking weed and having house parties, you know?
Yeah. But for all these kind of almost micro, not aggressions, but pushing the boundaries and also doing things that were really not good for me, especially as a diabetic.
Of course.
Take good care of myself. It was probably about this time that I started to realise that that I was gay.
Right.
You know, growing up in the 80s, 90s in the West Midlands as a gay man, there weren't really any support or resources.
Very interesting.
Or people to turn to. And I started doing, again, what are they called? Ads. What are they called? Personal ads in magazines.
Oh, interesting. To meet
men who were much older than me. And sort of, oh, yeah, I'm just off to Nottingham for the weekend. Well, bye.
Yeah.
To go and stay with a man I've never met.
Oh, wow. That's extraordinary.
Because she didn't know. I'd not told her.
Yeah.
So she didn't know where I was going or what I was doing. I just wasn't coming home. Quite a lot.
Wow. Gosh, that's extraordinary.
I feel
very fortunate
now that I didn't get into a pickle of some sort.
Yeah. What age are you now then in your tale?
We're 16
yep.
now. Got another tattoo along the way.
Yep.
A really bad one that I've still got on my shoulder of a dolphin, which kind of represented, freedom and all that. So, yeah, we're at 16. At this point, we start to find out that my dad's an alcoholic.
Interesting.
He'd been putting us in dangerous situations, driving and not turning up for things. You know, he was not... Sorry if you're listening, Dad, but this is all true.
Yeah, yeah. I know, it's tricky, isn't it? We divulge so many pieces of information. My mum, she's like, just listen to the episode about so-and-so. She goes, I didn't know you did that. And I'm like, I know. Sorry about that, Mum.
he was not much of a father figure to me in that I don't remember him teaching me anything about shaving or sex or any of the things that you're supposed to learn growing up from your dad.
Yeah.
And the strain on him and my mum's relationship was clearly sort of manifesting itself.
Of course.
At this point.
Yeah.
They were never argumentative or angry, but you can tell when you're living with them, can't you?
Definitely, 100%. Yes.
It's sort of kind of simmering, seething under the surface with my mum working all hours as a nurse.
Gosh.
But she'd done phenomenally she started out as a phlebotomist, taking blood.
Mm-hmm.
She'd become a nurse. Wow. And she was working on the district. She was doing pretty well for herself.
Mm.
Again, money was always tight, but we got by. And it's only as an adult looking back now that I can see how much they did for us as kids.
Yeah.
So
that's funny, isn't it? I think we're in our little worlds for the most part until we're not. And then we don't realise what effect our parents and their behaviour around us is having on us.
Mm, absolutely. Mm. We're just so self-centered.
Yes, we really are. Yeah.
Absolutely revolves around us.
Yeah, that's so true.
But despite having these friends who I was occasionally getting arrested with, and I made some friends from another school that I would hang out with, I still didn't really feel like I was part of it. Still felt like I was lying because it never came out.
Right.
So it was like there's this big bit of me that was secret and I couldn't share with anyone.
Did you have to engage in sort of bro-ish manly conversations about girls then?
Oh, yeah. I was known for being quite a ladies' man.
That's so funny.
So I was going from woman to woman.
Right.
A roguish chap. Finding something he could never find.
Yes.
In a lady.
Wow. Gosh, that's very, very interesting.
The stories there of getting chased by people whose partners I may have been.
Oh, wow.
Indulging in shenanigans with.
Okay. So.
So, university comes next. Oh, yeah, I'd fucked up my GCSEs, my A-levels completely. I'd managed to scrape by with sort of, I think I got a C in geography.
Yeah,
my A levels.
Right, for our international friends, 16 is the age where you do your GCSEs, and 18 is the age where you do your A levels just before you head off to university or college, as they call it out here in America, which is extremely confusing.
It is confusing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It took me years to figure that one out.
Yeah.
There should be some kind of international.
Is high school. School is high school. College is university. It's very, very confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Madness.
Mm-hmm.
University. So decided immediately. That was it. I was not hiding who I was. So came out to all my uni mates.
Mm.
And I hadn't really developed great social skills at this point. Mm. So I masked with drink and drugs.
Mm.
I spent most of my time at college, at university, high.
Mm.
I was doing coke and smoking a lot of weed. Spent my student loan on bag of coke, bag of weed, Sega Dreamcast.
Perfect. That's what student loans are for, by the way.
Yeah, Sonic Adventure, Crazy Taxi, those were the days. Those are things I could socialise around.
Yeah.
A bit of structure.
Yeah.
We're playing a game, we're doing a thing, we're getting high and we're doing this. And that was how I spent a number of years dropping out and redoing years.
Wow.
And going to work in a bar to make some money for the rest of the year.
Mm.
Until I think probably my third year, doing year two again.
Mm.
Glastonbury Festival.
Here we go. Okay, Robin, can I ask you a question before we move on to the Glastonbury experience?
Absolutely.
How was the coming out experience? Did you feel some sort of liberation having held it all in for so many years?
Yeah, 100%. It was like I was almost starting to live my authentic self to
right.
get all life coachy about it. I was still figuring out who I was. And what I was and what I wanted and how I did things. And having been to, I stayed at school rather than going to college for my sixth form, for my A-level education. And they treated us like kids still. I think had I gone to college and got a bit of autonomy and had to self-manage, self-regulate,
mm.
I would have been much more prepared
yeah.
to go to university. As such, I was an absolute fuckhead and in no way prepared for what university demanded of you.
Sure.
And what you had to do to get by. It was
yeah.
kind of my first taste of freedom and
yeah.
I went completely off the rails.
Yeah. It. Times have changed, haven't they? Right. So you get on into Glastonbury.
Get on into Glastonbury 2000. David Bowie is headlining Sunday night. All I can remember seeing from it is Moby, the Bloodhound Gang.
Yes.
And Travis as the only three acts I remember seeing.
Wow.
So we got in, we set up a tent, you know, near the stage. We're not going for one of the quiet fields. We're going right in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And Glastonbury, you know, it's nowhere near as big as it is these days. It's half the size,
yeah.
probably.
Yeah.
So, but still a flipping huge site. So it's time to hit it. It's time to get going. So we'd taken a few pills with us. We've taken plenty of booze with us. We've got some weed. We've got some speed. And, of course, there's dealers roaming around the site.
Yeah.
Quite freely. So we'd got what we'd got, which was quite a few speckly pills, some mitzies, you know, all the classics.
And these are again, do you like how I'm translating for international people? But these are ecstasy pills, by the way. So everything was related to in the patterns or the colours on the pills. So we'd have like green New Yorkers and smiley faces and speckles, speckly ones, right?
Speckly ones, which were usually a little bit smacky.
Yeah, great, perfect. Sounds good. Let's take the speckly ones because they're a bit smacky. Perfect.
Okay. Yeah, go party in Glastonbury on the smacky pills. Lovely.
Okay.
Oh, dear.
So good.
So off we went partying and a dealer's come around. One stuck his head in the tent. Do you want to buy anything? Sure. What have you got? So buy some more pills and get some more coke and he leaves and we notice he's dropped a baggie
in
the tent.
Oh, God.
So we now have this massive baggie full of mystery powder.
Oh, my God, no.
As well. So we're like, oh, we'll have that then. Brilliant. So now we've got everything we came with, these extra ones we bought, and this bag of mystery powder.
Oh.
Lovely. off we go into the sites. Like, oh yeah, let's have some absinthe. Let's oh yeah, we'll have some of them. The hash cakes, lovely. We'll have some of those. Which send two of our party into a real kind of paranoid state. Drug-induced paranoia.
Nice bit of kind of a hallucinogenic spirit in absinthe, followed by some hash cakes, and probably some of the other stuff on top of that will probably tend to do that to you, I'd imagine.
Yeah, so they weren't having a great time. Thought that everyone was trying to get them, so they had to go back to the tent. But they chilled out for a while and thought it'd be okay. Friday passes relatively without too much to write home about. We had a lovely time, stayed up late, got some sleep, and did okay for it. And Saturday comes around, and we hit it hard again. And at this point, I'm just going for it completely, buying pills off anyone who's selling them, washing them down. It turns out that I had 24 pills in 24 hours.
No, that's probably not recommended.
No, that's well above the recommended dose for anything of any kind, especially things where you don't know what they are.
It sounds we can get into this after, but it sounds like that kind of hedonism where you're taking drugs to lose your mind is just running away from things, isn't it? From a mental capacity, not wanting to deal and be as far away in your brain as humanly possible.
100%. And looking back now, I can see that I'm a man who has lived with anxiety his whole life.
Yes, same.
And these were all coping mechanisms. Yes, same. In a way to try and escape from it.
That's why I realised that, I think, when you were talking that way, because it sounds jolly much like what I used to do, you know? Mm. It's extraordinary. Okay, so the 24 pills in 24 hours. That's the third podcast I'm launching, by the way. This is great. You're giving me some ideas here.
And I remember walking back to the tent early in the morning, it must be the Sunday morning, and I started to go, oh, I don't feel to get to remember. Mm. I remember walking back from the cinema, they've just shown The Matrix, which you've not been able to watch because everyone's pointing laser pointers at the screen,
that's annoying.
So you can't see anything. And the sun's starting to come up, we're walking back to the tent, I remember I just go, oh, I don't feel great, and turn to my right and just do a little sick over my shoulder.
Right.
And then I don't remember anything else till Monday morning.
Oh, gosh.
Apparently, I was drifting in and out of consciousness, but I was just sort of abandoned in a boiling hot tent.
Oh, shit.
By my then boyfriend.
Oh.
Who he says he'd asked if I'd had my insulin and stuff, and I'd said yes, but I was not in any state of consciousness that I remember at any point.
And conceivably, he was just thinking you'd taken too many drugs and you needed some rest.
Just having a come down.
Yeah.
He's gone at it a bit hard.
Yeah.
Probably not had a drink of water, not been to the toilet the whole time.
Oof.
And probably not doing great. But I lost that day completely. I woke up on Monday morning thinking it was Sunday, with my boyfriend going, come on, it's time to go, we've got to pack up and leave. I can't move.
Shit.
Like, no, come on, stop it, it's time to go.
Yeah.
I'm like, but it's Sunday, no, we've got to go, come on. I'm like, I can't. And then I started, every breath was excruciating. The longer time went on, the more I started to scream with every breath.
Shit.
Because it was just so painful. Like, you've got to get help. You've got to get help now.
Oh,
I'm not okay. Of course, back then, Monday mornings at Glastonbury, everything's gone.
Yeah.
There's no health people around. There's no, they're trying to get the site cleared. There's no security. Everyone's fucked off.
Terrifying.
Eventually, probably an hour later, he manages to get help. At this point, I've been two of the people have gone. They've gone in the car.
Wow.
I've been sick in that. They left me a hat, which I've been sick in.
Wow.
Classic fisherman's hat.
Brilliant. That's helpful.
But it's got the little air holes.
Yeah, lovely. That's not good for anything, is it? That's not waterproof.
Hat full, hat full of sick.
Lovely.
It's bright green, leaking everywhere. Eventually, help comes, and it's the trash wagon.
Wow.
They load me onto the trash wagon.
Oh, my gosh.
To take me up to the medical tent.
Right.
At which point I go, shit, this guy's in trouble.
Right.
Get the helicopter now.
Shit.
Load me up into the helicopter. Give me a dose of morphine. Thank you very much.
That's what I needed at the beginning. What's wrong with you people?
Yeah. It'll be fine.
That's funny.
And I start to calm down. Like my breathing starts to regulate. I'm not screaming with every breath. And I'm looking up the incredibly handsome paramedic. He's like holding my hand and going, "You all right, mate? You all right? You all
oh
right?"
Oh my gosh!
I am now.
Was that your first trip? Was that your first trip in a helicopter?
It was my first trip in a helicopter. Yeah.
Yeah. So hold on, you got like first trip in helicopter, handsome medic, and morphine. You're probably thinking, "Oh, this is all right. I should do this more often."
Quids in, yeah. I was not expecting this when we set off for Pelton. And they took me to hospital, loads of tests, and they found out that I was essentially on the brink of renal failure. I put so much into my system that it couldn't cope anymore and was shutting down. And if it had been an hour longer, I might not have been with us anymore.
Oh my gosh. I mean, but it sounds like you knew at that point your body was saying, because I guess you've got, I think when you've been through a lot, when you know something's wrong and it's not just something you felt before, the fact that you were in your tent and you felt and you were like, something's not right, you got to get help, you just knew, didn't you?
Yeah, something bad is happening here. Shit. You've got to help me. I'm not capable of helping myself.
Oh my God, that's terrifying. So what was the recovery like from that? I mean, aside from the fact you had to come down off those 24 pills, the morphine and renal failure.
I had to come down off that in a very busy ward in the hospital, where, of course, they didn't treat me great because I was just some druggie
who'd
been brought in.
Yep.
They ran the tests, had a drip in my arm, and they were like, there was so much in your system.
Mm.
We need to keep you here because we think you've got a problem.
Wow. Yeah.
I was like, I promise you, I might have a problem, but it's not the problem that you think.
Right.
I've just been to Glastonbury and overdone it.
Yeah.
Can I go home?
Yeah.
No, we've got to keep you in. You're not ready to go home.
Wow.
My mum came down to visit me.
Wow.
My mum, the nurse.
Yeah.
And back then, GDPR wasn't quite what it is now. And my toxicology report was at the foot of my bed.
Oh.
She didn't say a word about it.
Oh,
she
wow.
never has.
Wow.
I've brought it up once or
twice. Do you think she had an inkling? Or do you think, as parents do, they've got their blinkers on and they're sort of like, if you're making it home at night or you haven't called or the police haven't been in touch, then you're okay, you know?
Yeah, I think she had an inkling. Mm. I think she knew that I'd gone off the rails and didn't really know how to bring me back in.
Mm.
She was dealing with her own stuff. Oh, yeah, at the same time, my dad had attempted suicide recently as well, round about then. So there was a lot going on.
Poor mum. Poor mum.
Yeah, poor mum.
Oh, indeed. Dear me. So, okay, so what happens next for you?
So 4 days later, I think they discharged me with a bottle of antibiotics and get my bags together. Worst train ride of my life. You know?
God, yes.
Making my way to the train station with bits and pieces and still, you know, a bag full of stinking Glastonbury clothes. It was feeling like death warmed up.
Yeah.
Made it home, had a bath, and then had to figure out what the hell am I doing with my life.
Yeah. So that obviously was a huge wake-up call for you. Was it that kind of an immediate thing where you thought, did you think you had a problem, or did you realise there was something major going wrong? Did you start to put it together that maybe there was more kind of mental health issues with this the anxiety and the running away?
It wasn't for years that I figured all of that out.
Yeah, fact, same for me.
Had a bit of a break from partying. It took me 6 months to recover from that, maybe a year.
Wow.
Aches and pains, and my lungs were shot to fuck, and I was peeing was weird.
Wow.
I was on antibiotics for a long time, but a lot of the infection that I had to go in for checkups to check on my kidney function and liver, all of that kind of stuff.
I mean, as much of a near death experience as one would ever hope not to have, isn't it? Quite frankly.
Yeah, it was close.
Yeah.
I don't know how close it was, but it was close.
Wow.
I'm lucky to be here. But I didn't make the most of it from that point on. I still just kind of bimbled along, got a job working in Asda, which is probably the UK equivalent of Walmart.
Yes, that is correct. I'd say that's about right.
It took years of figuring out who I am, what I am again. And I got back into partying, started going clubbing, and again to fit in, I got high every weekend with a group of clubby people.
Well, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. Like, unless you figure out what's going on, the patterns just repeat themselves.
Yeah, isn't it extraordinary that you've got to do
the work.
Yeah.
And a similar thing happened where we went out one night, as we always did a day's work at Asda on Saturday, went out in Birmingham on Saturday night, stayed up till 8 a.m., probably didn't sleep until the following night. And my parents were away again, and my then boyfriend drove me home, stayed over, and would take me to work in the morning. And in the morning, I thought I just had a really bad come down.
Right.
I can't get up.
Right.
I'm not well. Can't get up. And he had to call for help. Turns out I had viral meningitis.
Dear God, man. Wow. And that comes in from a weakened immune system or a... you know, I know a few people that have had that, and that's terrible. That can really fuck you up.
Yeah, so that was my first ever lumbar puncture.
Oh, and my God.
Drained the spinal fluid to find out what was in there. And again, that didn't stop me. Once I was well again, I carried on, and it's only years later, in my 30s, when I had to go, I've got to make some changes to my life because I am not okay.
Yeah. So did you have a kind of an epiphany moment, do you think? Or was it one morning or just you thought you just, sometimes it's just exhaustion. You're like, I can't carry on like this.
Do you know what? It was when I was 35.
Mm.
I'd recently taken a new job, which seemed like the logical next best step in my career.
Mm.
Paid more authority.
Mm.
It was further away. I was travelling from the East End into Balham and back every day.
Mm.
So big chunk of my day on that. I was eating my feelings. I was having two bacon baps from Greg's every morning.
Love it. Greg's the baker.
Yeah. I was chunking out. I was getting high still and drinking every night, bottle of wine.
Mm.
And I found myself crying on the Northern Line one day, like stood at the station, staring at the tracks, just in floods of tears.
Wow.
Like I wasn't considering jumping, which that possibly makes it sound like.
Sure.
But I was sort of thinking, what the fuck have I done with my life?
It caught up with you, which is a really great thing, funnily enough, isn't it? We've spoken to a few guests where they had a moment, you know, suddenly everything stopped being what it was. And they were like, you know, they just this wave of emotion. And they're like, wow, yeah, I've been running away or I'm not well.
Yeah, I've been running away for 30 years at that point.
Yeah.
And I had to make a change. And that was when, I quit my job.
Mm.
And that's it. I am leaving London forever.
Mm.
I'm going to Devon to walk on the moors and get a dog and stroke my beard
in the drizzle.
You know, very Austin,
lovely.
Very pulled up without the man with the scythe.
But I think you have to make drastic measures, don't you? Because if the hedonism is around you and your friends and London and, I don't know, the city or whatever, you have to, don't you? You've got to. Otherwise, you just, especially if you're a repeat offender, as it were, and you just can't stop.
Yeah, I very much fall back into those patterns if I don't check myself. I didn't actually leave in the end. I got myself a job that was much less pressure. Took some time to just think about it, think about who I was, what I was. Sort out therapy. Oh, my God. If I'd have had therapy sooner.
Yeah.
Everybody, no matter where you are in life, if you can afford it or if it's available to you, have therapy. It's wonderful.
Yeah. So where do you want to take us? What's now? Because we obviously love to focus on the redemption, the resilience, the strength, the courage, the hope, and all of those things are in abundance with your story. But I love that we spent so long getting us to the point where... No, I love it because in your case, the backstory is so extremely relevant. And it's, you know, I relate so much to everything you're talking about in terms of the partying, in terms of the latchkey kid, in terms of the not fitting in. It's been amazing. So therapy started for you, and then you had this epiphany and this realization that you haven't really been yourself, I guess, all your life. Time to start finding out who you really are.
It says I had sort of been living much more my authentic self since I'd moved to London. It was very much a level up, a growing up time for me, figuring out a lot of stuff. But I was still leaning on heavily on drink and drugs for confidence, for support, to quell the anxiety. And I started dabbling in things like neuro-linguistic programming and integral eye movement therapy, cognitive behavior therapy.
Yeah.
And I started studying them and learning them. I've become a NLP practitioner myself.
Oh, wow. Do you have a thing called EMDR over there?
We do. It's like the tapping.
Yeah, that's the tapping. Yeah. It's like tricking your brain into letting your subconscious thoughts come out because you're too busy concentrating on other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And IEMT, which is taking the eyes through specific movement patterns to access all the parts of your brain whilst thinking about emotions and sort of dialing, you almost go back in time to the time you first felt an emotion and change your opinion of it. It's interesting stuff. And I've worked with so many practitioners of all kinds of them. Timeline therapy and regression therapy and guided visualizations and all of this kind of stuff. And I've learned it and I've studied it and I've done coaching and mentoring and found people to learn from and study with and figure out who I am. Still confused as fuck.
But guess what? You're not taking 24 ecstasy tablets on a weekend, so...
No, absolutely not. And I'll go to a festival.
Yeah.
My friends might have some pills and go, do you want a pill? And I'll just go, no, thank you.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm all right. You know, maybe I have a cheeky balloon and a joint.
And no one's judging. You can do entirely what you like, you know, at this stage. But so is that your living now?
It is. I now work with geeks and nerds, essentially.
Right.
And introverts. To help them with their, not just their confidence. I'm not a therapist, I'm a coach, essentially. And I work with them to help them grow their audiences. There's so many streamers, podcasters, YouTubers who are really lacking in self-belief and confidence to put themselves out there. And the people who are doing great work but aren't doing the rest of the stuff around it. To get their work in front of the right people.
Wow.
So I help them grow their audiences. I don't tell them that they're there to work on their self-belief and their confidence.
Sure.
I sell them the outcome, which is the audience growth.
Right.
And they get all of that included along the way.
That's amazing. We have to wrap up. What we do is that on the podcast episode notes, we'll put some links so people can track you down and find you, because I think that it would be crazy if people hadn't got an incredible amount from your story, knowing that you're talking to people and helping people, especially people that have a lack of confidence, a lack of self-esteem, struggle with fitting in, struggle with finding their purpose. I mean, your story is, it's been brilliant to talk to you.
Thank you. Essentially, I put together what I needed 20 years ago. If I can help just one person to not follow the same path of mistakes that I've made, then I've succeeded.
Well, to be fair, that's kind of why we launched this podcast. Kyle had some sexual trauma in his past, and I had some extreme kind of self-esteem issues and trauma from my friend dying and grief and all sorts of stuff like that came out in horrible ways. And it's very cathartic and therapeutic just having people on and talking to them about all the stuff that they went through and the fact that they all got better or they're getting better and they're focusing on, you know, it gives everyone hope. It just gives everyone hope. And your story is going to give so many people some hope. So I'm so happy that we got to meet.
No, thank you. I love what you're doing with the show, and I'll be sharing it around because it's exactly that. It's showing people that there are ways through, that there are examples of other people doing it, and there's so much hope in the world.
Well, let's leave it there. I'll see you at Glastonbury 2022, and I'll be the one with the neon hat and the gloves on and the whistle like an old school raver.
I'll have plenty of flashing lights about my body, don't you worry.
Love it. Robin, thank you.
Thanks, Luke.